Hey, we've got both Mel and Gordon in that order. Mel, go ahead.
Well, one of the questions that's always bothered me is why the same noise source, and I can recognize sometimes the noise source, why is it a different to the factor that sometimes it's stronger and sometimes it's weaker? Does it really have propagation also? I mean, is that a factor that there's actually propagation in the noise source? I could say the angle usually will sit approximately the same, but the noise source will go many times higher and sometimes a lot lower, but it's the same source. That's what I can't understand. What is causing the difference in its gain there, Silver?
Hey, Mel, are you using a DTMS mic?
He asked, are you using a DTMF? He's using a fan because his house is hot, and he's using a rotary fan above his head. When he turns it on, he gets that tone in the background. Is that approximately what's going on there, Mel?
Now, I've been in the kitchen and the dining area here. The fan is a big fan. It's one of the big bladed things, monsters. It's got a green band on it, and it's pushing a lot of air because we were just finished dinner here, so trying to get the place a little bit more comfortable, but I can hear the wind noise it's creating definitely, Dick, over.
Yeah, it sounds like a DTMF mic with a duck button.
No, he thinks it's a touch tone. I'm not so sure, although it could be. Mel, just for the hell of it, it's not wind noise we're hearing. We're hearing a continuous tone in there, approximately a 1KC or 800 hertz note. Temporarily turn off that fan and give us a couple of words, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, hold on. Okay. Now I hear it myself. Where is that coming from? Hold on.
Okay. Turning off the fan didn't do it. The tone is still there. Okay, while Mel is searching that down, Glenn, give us some words that you've got. KC2QIQ, go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel, and the TechNet. Just a couple of quick things about some measurements I made just even a couple months ago, and I kind of verified it again last weekend after last weekend's TechNet when we were talking about this. I have a rotatable 10 through 20 meter beam, and it's kind of narrow banded to a few hundred kilohertz in the 10 meter. 20, you know, 12 and 17 meter band, and I took the measurements with an HP spectrum analyzer that I have here at the house, and I took the antenna and I started putting it vertical and horizontal just to verify what I saw about a year ago, and definitely in the vertical position, noise floor, not the absolute signal peaks that I'm seeing across the band, but when I do a sweep from 30 megahertz down to about, I don't know, somewhere around 10 megahertz, the noise floor that I'm seeing is when I in the vertical mode and I point the beam west towards the city, that's where the noise floor actually lifts 20 dB higher than if the beam were vertical and stayed and pointing east. So, and anywhere in between, the noise floor kind of shifts up and down a little bit. So it's really like the difference between like minus 60 dB noise floor on the spectrum analyzer and the antenna versus minus 40 when I'm pointing west. So the noise floor, I guess when it mixes with other signals, it's probably why we're hearing such a noise difference with the S-meters on the radio, but that's just a guess on my part. Back to you, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Okay, there's a little bit of confusion in my mind now. When you aim toward New York City, you get the greatest amount of noise. Your antenna is rotatable in polarization. I guess you got something like an alliance rotator in the middle of the boom, so you can rotate it from horizontal to vertical. And when you aim toward New York City, you get the greatest noise. Is it horizontal or vertical that you get the greatest noise? I'll come back with that one again. Glenn, go ahead. Sorry about that, Gordon.
No, it was Glenn. It was right the first time. Yes, when I'm in vertical mode, the noise is the highest when it's pointed towards the city. If I go into the horizontal position, it's still very high, but I would say it's probably 6 to 8 dB less. But when I go to the easterly direction, I get the lowest noise floor, I should say. Not so much the peaks. The peaks don't move nearly as radically. that the noise floor was right. So very surprising that when the beam's in a horizontal position and points east, I get a very, very low noise floor. As a matter of fact, the quietest noise floor is actually south, southeast, and it's actually northeast where I actually start to see the largest amount of noise in the vertical position there.
Okay. When I stand on top of my tower and I look toward New York City, I see a lot of vertical objects. And Glenn is getting a lot of vertically polarized noise when he aims his antenna toward New York City. Part of the variability that Mel is asking about, I see from day to day when I just watch Channel 2 television over the broadcast. I'm one of those few guys that doesn't have cable TV. And so the insulators, not the insulators, the connectors, all three lines, the phase A, phase B, and phase C of the 13.2 kilovolt line, line-to-line voltage, 7,800 volts to ground, those three high-tension distribution wires on the top of the utility poles that go down my block, all three of them got severed by a massive tree during Hurricane Gloria. The repair crew came along and used these aluminum objects that look like Chinese finger torches and plugged the two ends of the broken aluminum wire into it, and it locked it very nicely. Mechanically, the three wires are now connected, but one of those three wires, almost every night of the week, I can walk out there, I can see the blue sizzling sparks around that thing. I watch my television set, and I can see two horizontal white bars slowly walking up the screen in a 15-second period. So, local noise. There are some days that it's absolutely not there, and there are some days when it's really loud and makes my Channel 2 television not so good. Also, another thing I see lately is that the darn thing acts like a rectifier. I should see two bars across the screen. I see 1.01 bars. In other words, I see one bar at the top, one bar at the bottom. There should be another white bar in the middle, and the white bar in the middle is 98% gone, as if the coupling device on the distribution high-tension line in front of my house acts like a rectifier. It breaks down better in one direction than the other. That's another crazy thing it was doing for the last couple of nights. So I get huge variability of that 60-cycle noise coming from the peaks of the current on those arcing connectors, aluminum to aluminum oxide going on. I sure wish that that line had been thoroughly replaced as opposed to being spliced. If you have any further comments on this, give me a call at us right now, K2RAW and the TechNet.
Carl Eifert, FIK.
I don't think so. From their point of view, those three splices put in right after Hurricane Gloria are functioning very well. And the fact that I see noise on my television screen, and I'm one of the foolish guys that doesn't have cable TV, as far as they're concerned, I'm an oddball. They've got a working system. It's meeting spec. Unless I had some real political clout, I don't think they're going to listen to me, Eric. Over to you, Eric, for a comment on that one.
I don't remember the guy's name. I can find out. There's a guy that takes care of, you know, all the power line noise complaints. And he's actually got the power that can take care of it. Because a lot of times, if you're seeing power line noise like that, there's also spikes in all of the aircraft then. And if you pull out a spectrum analyzer and you actually see something between, I would say, 117, 116, and say 130, and they don't want to do anything about it, and I've had some other people do this and it works great, you call the FAA. They do something about it.
Yeah, I know what you're referring to now. You're referring to the cumulative leakage index, FAA frequencies. My television aerial on the roof of the house connected to the chimney is about 25 feet off the ground. These wires are probably 55 feet off the ground. My antenna looks straight into them. My television aerial looks straight into them. On channel 2, the noise is tolerable. Channel 4, it's a lot weaker. Channel 5, it's a lot weaker. When channel 6 is in there from Philadelphia, it's almost gone. Channel 7, I never see it. So it's not super loud. It falls off at 60 feet per octave. I'm the only guy for miles and miles around that's watching over-the-air broadcast. I'm not on cable. I guarantee by their normal standards, it is meeting specification. I'm an oddball. I'll give it a try when you tell me the name of the man, but Maybe I'm being pessimistic, Eric, but I think the chances of me getting a solution to that particular minor problem is rather slim. Of all the problems I got to solve, this is not the one on the top of my priority list. Over to you, Eric.
Hi, K2RWK2J. I guess his name. That's all he does is he takes care of their complaints. He's been there since the days of Loco. And let's put it this way. You know, the average little old lady, they bring them in the house and they see the garbage on the TV, and then all of a sudden it goes away and makes the little old lady happy. You know, that's the approach you can take.
Yeah, I'm the only little old lady around for miles. I can drive up and down the streets of my town, Huntington. I cannot find an operating television aerial on the roofs of any of those houses. And I know for a fact that unless they've got an aerial on the roof of the house, if they don't have cable TV of some kind, or satellite TV, they're not going to be getting very many channels in my town. Or too many miles away, and the trees are too dense, and so on. And I'm one of the few guys who lives on top of the hill, and I've got good line of sight to Empire State Building. So I'm an oddball. I'll be amazed if they respond to that. So we know a little bit more about noise, as I see it, Joe. We don't have the whole story, but we're going to keep working on it. W2RYY for any other comments. K2RYW in the TechNet.
But just a comment in general at it, of just something I heard on the radio that happened. We're all familiar with lightning and how it can be dangerous and so forth. I guess the general consensus is seems to be that you're rather safe, you're safer in an automobile than being standing outside. An incident that happened up in Rochester, Minnesota, about just after the I think I heard it like Monday or Tuesday. A kid was in a car. The car had a metal roof. Lightning hit the car, came through the windshield, and hit the kid in the shoulder. Now, what do you have to say about that? I thought a car tends to act more like a Faraday shield and prevent the lightning from coming inside it. Sound like a very strange occurrence, don't you think?
Without a doubt, Joe. Very strange occurrence. Nothing is perfect. You and I can put the world's best surge arrestors on every one of our antennas, every one of our power lines, UPSs, whatever. We can protect ourselves up the kazoo. You get a direct lightning strike on your tower or your power line outside your house, and there's a fair probability you're going to suffer some damage. By the same token, 99% of the time, that Faraday metal shield of a automobile, lightning-wise, is about the safest place you can be. Not perfect. And I would much rather be in a non-convertible car than a convertible car. There's nowhere near as much metal over your head in a convertible. A buddy of mine, as a change of life, bought himself a car. That's a convertible. Beautiful looking thing. In the summertime, to ride down with a ride with the top down is a lot of fun. With the top up, you take a long trip in a convertible car. And my goodness, have my standards changed. The very first car I owned was a convertible when I first got out of college. I loved the thing. My standards for noise were nowhere near what they are now. Nowadays, I drive a four-door sedan, which will, with the windows up and the air conditioning turned on, I can turn the radio on real low and I have no trouble hearing it. I can hear my ham radio. The car is quiet. You drive in a modern-day convertible, and you will be amazed how much road noise of trucks and cars and whatever comes through that ragtop of that convertible. And me and my buddy driving in his convertible car were on a fairly long trip, and I tried holding a conversation with him. And I basically got hoarse because I had to shout so loud so that me sitting in the passenger seat and him in the driver's seat right alongside could hear each other because of all the road noise. Because of that, I used to love convertibles. I've lost that love. And now, when I think about lightning, that's another reason why I'm not so happy about a convertible. Car is still the safest. The big controversy, let me drop. When you're in a car and a tornado comes along, should you hide under a bridge? Well, if you can climb way up inside of the ironwork of the bridge, you seem to be safe. But there's only a couple of spaces for human beings up there. Everyone else is going to be below that spot. And the Don Bridge acts as a wind tunnel, and they're trying to convince us that you're not as safe hiding under a bridge in a tornado. That's a tough one. What do you do in a tornado? Thank goodness we're not in Tornado Alley. But we saw, we do get some significant lightning here, and don't know what to tell you. Anyone got any comments on Joe's lightning question, give me your call letters right now. H-U-R-A-W in the TechNet. Okay, I heard Eric. Who's the other person?
A-E-Y.
Okay, Eric and Mel in that order. Eric, go ahead.
Now, interestingly enough, at 6:14 this evening, I was sitting in the transmitter room, and all of a sudden there's this huge white flash, and I couldn't hear for about 5 minutes. After that, my digital transmitter just couldn't deal with it whatsoever, and it decided to turn itself off and make some interesting smells. The analog transmitter was very happy, it didn't even flinch. All the network stuff dropped dead. There's a firewall in there, that piece of equipment, that's fried. The intercom in the place is, I had to reset that, that weirded out. All sorts of good stuff that's still broken, but I decided I had enough because I can't get the connectivity back to New York. I just basically gave up for the moment. But that's my lightning story. I haven't many more, but that was a few hours ago.
Wow. So are you telling me your digital transmission from Channel 21 area is essentially off the air tonight? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
No, negative. I fixed it. I got it working. It's almost at full power. I've got to get another module for it. I suppose I could put little gaps in the board, but I don't think so. You know, I'm a service contract, so you just send them the bad board. Besides, they're probably just going to throw it out.
So until you, so one of your transmitting modules failed, does that mean you're down to something like 80% of normal digital power output? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's, now, each one of the boards generate about, 800 watts. So, down 800 watts. Big deal.
Reminds me of that flight joke where two pilots are trying to land at the same airport. One of them's a B-52 bomber, and the other one's some kind of a light airplane. And the light airplane is told to go into a holding pattern because the B-52 is about to land, and he declared an emergency. He's got an engine that's out. And the snotty private pilot says, "Oh no, another one of those dreaded seven-engine landings." A B-52 has eight engines. A dreaded seven-engine landing. And he's declaring emergency. Okay, KE2EJ, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, change lights with Eric. You know, the oscillation that you heard is caused when the central air conditioning comes on, first of all, Vic. Can you imagine that? And then I'll make another comment, over.
Yeah, we're still hearing that tone, Mel. And so, any idea what it's being caused by? Go ahead.
Yeah, something with the air conditioning system. Well, I got the fan also running now, and that's another thing. But the tone, I think, is if I turn off the central air conditioning when it cycles the compressor, I heard it disappear. So I don't know. I think, but I'll tell you, the lights in the kitchen I'm looking here are dim. The lighting is dim. I bet you, yeah, I'm going to check it. I bet you my line voltage is down quite a bit, Dick. Over.
Yeah, a couple of lightning strikes did happen pretty close to my house. I don't think it struck the tower, although it's kind of hard to tell because the tower is grounded by so many things. And let's see now, going down the list, I think we had, yeah, Paul. We bypassed Paul, WS2N. I bet you got a question or a comment. Go right ahead, Paul, if you're still there. K2RAW and the TechNet.
The one question I wanted to bring up, I want a comment about the lightning, Dick. I got a very interesting story, K2KY.
Okay, go ahead with the lightning story, Mel.
Okay. I ran into somebody I hadn't seen in many, many years. And we got talking about this and that, and what have you been doing? He got a very interesting job, and I mean an interesting job. He doesn't pay very well. I says, yeah, what was that? He says, well, I got a job with the Atomic Energy Commission. I says, oh, great, AEC. He says, yeah, they trained me to dismantle nuclear bombs. I says, what? Yeah, he said, out west, they got this place. He says, underground, these vaults. You're in this closed thing, and you take apart a nuclear bomb. I says, oh, for God's sake. So So I says, gee, I says, isn't that kind of a dangerous job or something? He says, taking apart a nuclear bomb. He says, only, he says, when there's lightning. I says, what do you mean by lightning? I thought you were really underground. He says, we cannot do anything when there is lightning because they have detected lightning even down in those vaults at times. So they stop all operations in the dismantling vault when there's lightning anywhere in the area. Can you imagine that, Dick? Over.
It's a good rule to be on the safe side. The 800 hertz tone occasionally gets equally as loud as your audio, and there are times when it's 10 or 15 dB weaker than that. It goes up and down in a somewhat continuous manner, as if you're walking around the room with a mic or moving the mic cord or whatever. That tone goes up and down during your transmission, Mel. Go ahead.
I'm in the one spot here, but I see, like, the lights keep dimming. You know, every time the compressor kicks on, I see the meter on the power supply dip also because, the compressor really draws a lot. We don't have sufficient lines here. This I can tell you. The electric surface here in the backyard here is a whole block is connected to this, 1, 2, 3 wires, the neutral and 2, 1, 10. And this is the whole block, and everybody's got central air conditioning, and I guarantee every one of them is on now. So I can see the dimness in the lights, and I can hear when the compressor kicks on, I can hear the thing go, change the tone, go woo, woo, as the compressor comes on. And my neighbors, when it comes on, again, the same thing. It seems like each one of them is creating another, some kind of a crazy reaction here, Dick. First time I've ever seen this kind of reaction. I mean, this year at least, over.
That sure is a loud 800 hertz tone you're transmitting there, Mel. Would it be fun for you to go get your digital voltmeter and find out what voltage you're running on? I've also got a line voltage story, which when we go through our list of questioners tonight, I'll give that to you guys as a puzzle. It's a goodie, something I discovered in the last 2 days. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead with whatever you would like to give us. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No, I didn't have any questions as far as the STS-124 Discovery. That's been up there. It's a little over halfway through their mission. 7 astronauts that went up, they're doing quite good. They've already installed a Kaibo Japanese unit to the Harmony module as part of the International Space Station. And they're going to relocate the other piece of Kaibo that they had brought up on the previous mission, which is temporarily stored to the station. They'll put that attach that to the Kaibo module later on in the mission. That's a big piece. That's 37 feet long, 14 and a half feet diameter. Interesting clip I saw on TV. They were wondering, it's so big in diameter, so much space. They were thinking, oh, maybe if you're floating out here, you wouldn't be able to move, your body one way or the other. Maybe you could push the air, try to swim over to the end. You might get stuck in the middle. And they had one guy floating out there, and he's on the short side. And whatever he did, he couldn't get over to the walls or the ceiling. It looked like he was stuck there forever. But eventually what happens is the vent, there's an exhaust vent that the air tends to move you over to the exhaust vent. So eventually you wind up there anyway, which is what he did. But it's a big, very big unit. But that's the biggest of all the little homes that are attached to the space station. Now, quite a few of them drop it. And you've got the living modules of the Zesley, the Russian module, that's all of it. Bathroom problems that was talked about so much on sort of media this week. The Zarya cargo block, the functioning cargo block that's like basically an equipment room you can float around in that. And forward of that, you've got a node that's connecting a Lego type piece. Six different sides, you can connect everything you want to it, float around and that. That turn is connected to other things. You know, you're connected to the Destiny Lab. You're also connected to the Quest module, which is got its own separate room to decompress for spacewalks, and that's how they, one of the doors they go out for spacewalks out of the Quest Lab, Quest module. And then in front of the Destiny, the American Destiny, you've got another node called Harmony, and attached to that, you've got this big, gigantic living area that was bought up by, you know, for the European Space Agency called Columbus. Now you've got the Kaibo unit attached to that, Harmony unit as well. A lot of living space. Plenty of places to float up there. Let me drop it. And plenty of places to float on the outside. You know, that truss section is some 300 feet long. You've got three sets of gigantic solar arrays, 240 feet by 40 feet each. Another set yet to go up. But I think it's big. They say when it goes over at night, it's like the brightest star in the sky. When you look at it in the dawn or at night. So they're doing well. And you've got the Phoenix mission still doing its work that landed last week. Or was that the week before? It was the week before the Phoenix mission landed. And heard they're digging up soil. Last I heard, a little bit of soil did not make it into the oven to be tested. It looks like it got all over the top of it. But I didn't check the internet today, so maybe they've corrected that problem. So, quite a few things going on with the man and robotic mission, Dick. But I really don't have much to add. And what I've told you is pretty much on the internet, NASA.gov. What small clips you do find on the news or the newspaper. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Quite nice, Mel. Paul. I'm looking at the New York Times Sunday, June 1 issue, and I guess this is the national section, and it talks about the launch of Discovery and the Kaibo, a $1 billion module. It's one of three parts, and when it's all put together, it's going to be the largest room up there. During the launch, approximately five pieces of foam came off the external tank, and some of them struck the shuttle. But it wasn't significant because it occurred after the critical time during the launch when those chunks of foam can do damage. I presume what goes on is that later on in the launch, when you're up at a higher altitude and there's less air to push against the chunks of foam and you're not getting quite as much thrust out of the engines, you don't have as much foam acceleration. Therefore, the foam doesn't have the ability to hit the shuttle with as high a velocity and do damage. Also, I think on this particular launch, they launched on the very first day of opportunity, whereas if you have to wait for the second day and all those cryogenically cold chemicals are sitting, your oxygen and hydrogen are sitting in the external tank collecting more and more ice and frozen water in that foam, I think a launch on the second day is considerably more dangerous than the first day. That's an opinion on my part. But still, those five pieces of foam that fell off tells me that that problem is not exactly solved. It's still a bit of a risk. Another thing they mentioned is that the station maintenance is going to be during one of the spacewalks, they're going to be testing techniques for cleaning the malfunctioning rotary joint that is a critical part of the station's power supply. The joint is 10 feet in diameter, and it's one of the rotary joints for the solar arrays. And there's metal chips in one of those that's grinding up, and they're going to try to clean out those chips. That's going to be replaced at some later time. So it's beginning to sound to me like either the metal chips grinding up in that bearing, insufficient lubrication or whatever, or there really are slip rings and not the magnetic coupling on all the power of those solar arrays. But can you imagine that rotary joint, Paul, is 10 feet in diameter? I knew it was big, but I didn't think it was that big. So I wonder if you've heard some of these words. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I think that's the T5 and the S5 truss assemblies. I think the 4 and 5, and 4 and 5 T for port side, as for starboard. I had problems with the starboard side, you saw the ground up pieces. Now they wanted to look at the port side, and instead of finding ground up pieces, they found too much grease on the rails. I was concerned about that. There was some little metal filings there, but they don't think it looks like the same ones as the other side. So on one of the spacewalks, they're supposed to take some tape, I guess duct tape or something, put it along the rail and pull it back off and then bring it back into the space station, eventually back to Earth for the lab to take a look at the filings, see what they're looking at, see what they're up against. But yeah, that's all those gigantic solar arrays, they're supposed to turn, you know, once every hour and a half on these gigantic when they put it up, the diameter was, I think, 14 by 14, the truss section. So I guess internal to that is probably 10-foot ring, diameter ring. So, yeah, good luck with that. They need that operational to supply all these labs. They need the solar panels to constantly face the sun. In fact, they need another set of solar panels. So, I mean, they eventually want to handle a bigger crew, too. They always have three. Eventually, they would like to have six on board permanently when we drop it. So, hopefully that works out, Dick. I don't think you mentioned something else earlier on. Oh, yeah. The piece is coming off the tank. Yeah, after they get higher in the atmosphere, the air gets a little rarefied, so they don't seem to worry about it after a certain period of time as much. Now, this is the first time they have a completely new tank, new everything. This is one of the redone, I mean, from the initial building of this tank. And that's why if you look at the shell going up, it's got a greenish tinge to it. It's got like a little different color when you're looking back at the tank through the camera. And it looked very smooth, but there were some pieces that came off. I saw them come off. And we record these. I definitely saw it come off. But and they were saying, oh, it looks smooth. But when you review the tape, you can see it. Of course, they really review it. It'd be interesting to see where it came up, it came off from. Usually they have one astronaut filming the external tank as it rolls away after the shuttle separates, after main engine cutoff, the tank separates after 8 minutes. And one astronaut's job is to get good photographic, high quality pictures of the tank before it descends and burns up. The ocean. They would take pictures of it. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
Yeah, one other thing they said about the 10-foot diameter joint. NASA has idled that joint last year, so they're no longer rotating that particular joint, the one that's grinding up, and I think you're saying it's the one on the port side. That implies that particular solar cell is not rotating once every revolution. Therefore, the solar cells are not giving them quite as much power as they could if that one was in rotation. So I'm guessing they're rotating on one side but not the other side. Is that approximately true, Paul?
I haven't heard that they were rotating at all outside of initial testing. And when the shuttle docks, they don't rotate, definitely. Or the Russians or anybody. Even the new ATV, the new supply ship that European Space Agency launched from French Guiana. When that went up there and docked, everything would always shut down. So, I mean, that's the plan when they do any kind of docking or any missions like that are going on. But I don't believe I've heard that they've left them rotating at all, Vic, so I really can't say for sure. I think ever since they found these problems, they've left it where it is. To change out something like that would be a major, major task. I think the space shuttle, which is supposed to be grounded in 2010, I don't think they'll have enough time to do it. Next big flight, October, is up to the Hubble Space Telescope, Dick. That's what we got look forward to this October. Originally it was August, but now it's October. Thank you.
And I'm a little bit concerned with the chunks of foam still falling off the tank. Had the foam done any damage to the wings of the shuttle on this trip? They're still going to the space station, and the space station acts like a lifeboat. You can stay there, send up another ship, bring them back down. And so there's all kinds of protection mechanisms. You fly to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's an entirely different orbit, and there is no protection. You're going to come back down from that particular orbit. And so I'm not convinced they've perfected a repair procedure yet in space for fixing a damaged tile. Looks like I forgot Alex. Sorry about that, Alex. Or maybe it's in the order in which everyone signed in. N2, November uniform. I think you had a question for us or a comment. Go right ahead, Alex. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, hello, Dick. Hello, everybody. Now, I said perhaps, in the opportunity, in the case that I would not understand something, I have no questions. Sorry for that. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. I ran into something that struck me interesting. I was reading a website that gave me a piece of information. At first, it didn't sound reasonable. I went and checked it, and I think it's accurate. It was a little bit of an electronic puzzle. Make believe you got a long piece of 20-gauge wire made out of copper, and you got 5 amperes of DC current flowing through it continuously. And you're watching, on average, the rate at which the electrons propagate down that wire. How fast do you think those electrons are moving in that wire? I'm not saying how fast do you get signaling on the wire. In other words, you make contact at one end, and a sensor on the other end says, aha, the voltage is there. That's not what I'm asking. I'm saying during the time that steady state current of 5 amperes is flowing in a piece of 20 gauge wire, that's the proper amount of current, by the way, for that gauge wire, 5 amps is flowing, 20 gauge wire, how fast, on average, are the electrons moving? Or another way of looking at it is you watch the red electron come out of the battery, and how fast is he trundling down that piece of 20 gauge wire on average? Somebody out there give me a guess on this one. I found it fascinating. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KY.
Mel's got a guess. Anyone else?
I guess it will take forever. As long as there is no no alternating current, the electrons don't have motive way to move. They will initially move, the potential will charge, but the electrons will not move. I think the speed is very, very slow.
Okay, at first you said they would not move, and then you said very, very slow. Do you want to give us an approximate magnitude? How slow are they moving in your mind, Eric? I mean, Alex?
Oh, perhaps 1 meter per hour or less than that.
Interesting number. Okay, so we've got Mel's about to give us a guess. Alex has given us a guess. One last chance. Anyone else want to give us a guess? Give me your call letters right now. Anyone give us a guess? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, looks like only those two brave souls. Mel, what is your guess? K2KEY? K2LIW?
K2QIQ?
Okay, we're going to get Mel first, and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I think they're standing still. Yeah, ask me, Dick.
Okay, you say the velocity is zero. Alex has given us approximately a meter per hour. Glenn, what do you say?
Well, I guess I'm looking at this question in two parts, because there's an orbit speed, in other words, the speed at which it's moving around the nucleus of whatever the material is, let's say the wire is copper. So there's an orbital speed and a magnitude between the valence of the valence shell. Now, if you're talking about the one electron leaving the first atom in the battery down to the end of the wire, I'd say that doesn't happen. But in other words, what you're seeing is the energy moving or nudging the energy of the next valence shell next to it. So you're seeing the chain reaction of energy moving down the wire. But I have to agree with limited to no motion of the electron through the wire.
Okay, so both you and Mel said zero, and Alex said 1 meter per hour. Alex wins. The exact answer is 1 millimeter per second. And since the 3,600 seconds per hour, the exact answer is 3.6 meters per hour. 1 millimeter per second is 5 amperes, 20 gauge wire, copper. Amazing to me. Yeah, the signaling happens at the speed of light. Send a radio wave down there, and these electrons are moving back and forth. And by the way, here's something interesting. In the case of 60 cycle current, those electrons are moving at 5 amperes. On the first half cycle, they're moving 1 millimeter per second to the right, and then the second half of the cycle, 1 millimeter per second to the left is their velocity. But your 60 cycle power that we've got here in the United States, 1/120th of a second, you've got positive voltage, and 1/120th of a second, you've got negative voltage. So 1 millimeter divided by 120 is the real motion. It would take a microscope if you could, on the assumption you could see the electron itself, to see the motion of the electron due to the 60 cycle current, and you're making a slow motion movie, it would take you a microscope to see that small amount of motion. Electrons have got a lot of charge, and they don't move very far. Remember that puzzle I gave where on a cold morning you turn on your starter motor of your automobile and assume 200 amperes is flowing from the 12 volt battery through that great big braided copper cable down to the starter motor. And you watch that red electron coming out of the battery, and on average, you measure how long it takes him to get to the starter motor. And on the assumption your starter motor could take it, your battery's got enough energy, the answer is 4 hours. So we take 4 hours at a 200 ampere rate, let me drop, for a single electron to propagate from atom to atom. The electrons do have to flow in order to make current. And 4 hours would take for that red electron coming out of the battery in this mythical experiment to get from the battery all the way down to the starter motor. If Mother Nature would let you do it, if she would let you drain the free electrons that are in that copper cable, even though it's not connected to the battery, if she would let you create that imbalance, you could drain electrons out of that copper cable at the rate of 200 amperes for 4 solid hours. Amazing. When you study what an ampere is, what a coulomb is, and what a farad is, they're tied together in a very funny way. If you've got a capacitor that starts off uncharged, and you put 1 ampere of current into it for 1 solid second, and if the voltage on the capacitor increased by 1 volt, that is the definition of a farad. 1 ampere second, 1 coulomb of charge, 1 volt of change is defined as 1 farad. And how many electrons actually move for that 1 ampere of current? And the answer is 6 × 10⁻¹⁸ electrons. Each electron's got 1.6 × 10⁻¹⁹ coulombs of charge. There's a funny tie-in. Current is defined in coulombs. Farads is defined in coulombs. Current is defined as coulombs per second. The amount of charge of each electron is measured in coulombs. It sounds like very cyclic definition. I'm kind of amazed that it all comes together. But it does. It's a system of units we don't often get into, but it's the electronics we all work with. So that 60 cycles current flowing in the wiring, let me drop, of your house, those electrons are dancing back and forth. On average, a very small fraction of a 1 millimeter of distance. Each millimeter, by the way, is 39 thousandths of an inch. That's because it's 39.37 inches per meter. So a millimeter, a thousandth of a meter, is 0.039 inches. 39 thousandths of an inch is a millimeter. And that's how fast the electrons move at 5 amperes on a 20-gauge piece of copper wire. 1 millimeter per second. At 60 cycle power, they're moving 1/20th of that distance back and forth. We used to make jokes about the fact that the electrons flow out of LIPA's power station, flow into our house, and then we feed them back. They really just sit in that cable and dance back and forth. They jump from one electron, from one copper molecule to the next. The current really does have to move, but the charge of each electron is, by some standards, so large, or there's so many of them, that very little actual motion takes place in order for it to be a significant current. Crazy stuff. And all of this is a great theory. No one has ever had a microscope large enough in magnification that has really seen an electron. And I guess because, as Glenn was telling us, they're in orbit around their individual nucleus of that particular copper molecule, and there I think they're moving at the speed of light in their orbit. We're just talking about the average hopping from one copper molecule to the next copper molecule. That's the real electron current flow. They do have to move, otherwise there wouldn't be current flow, is my understanding. Anybody got any further comments or questions on all this jazz? Someday we're going to understand it all. K2RIW on the TechNet. Give me your call letters right now.
We should contest the pricing of Con Edison, because in the last instance, the electrons go back to them.
Yeah, they're pretty stingy with them, though, Alex. They give us a few electrons, and they take them right back. And the electrons they're giving us move a very small fraction of an inch down the cable, and then come right back. Energy is flowing. But for you and I to say that any one of the electrons that comes out of Con Edison really gets all the way down that wire to your house, I think you could say with 99.99% assurance, most of the time that does not happen. Those electrons in that wire between that power station and your house, and there's a bunch of transformers and voltage conversions and everything else going on in between, but in general, those electrons are really like marbles in a pipe. They push one marble into the pipe at one end, and you and I watch a marble pop out of the pipe on the other end. But the marbles never get very far. The electrons never get very far. I think on average, they never move more than a small fraction of an inch. And yet, zillions of watts of power is flowing. Even though the current is higher, in the wiring that comes straight out of Con Ed or LIPA, Wilco, in order for the high current cables to have the ability to carry the extra current, by definition, the cable is much larger in diameter. Therefore, the surface area, if you did a slice to it, is much larger. And therefore, a larger number of electrons are moving. But again, they don't have to move very far. So even the higher current of the real power coming straight out of the power station, you would think the electrons have to move a lot further, because there's more copper atoms there, and more electrons are involved. On average, those electrons still don't go very far. Kind of opposite from common sense until you dig into the particulars. K2RIW listening. Okay. Anybody have any further questions or comments on that before we go to Mel's mailbag? Give me your call letters right now.
WA2CDL.
Hey, Andy. I'm trying to remember who we talked to earlier today. Oh, yeah. A couple of guys were worried about whether or not their audio is the right volume. And I told them, you run a great clinic at all of the landmark get-togethers, where you've got your IFR, service monitor, and you can set up the PL tone amplitudes and the audio tone amplitudes and so on. Go ahead, Andy. And how's, you're pretty happy with the way the repeater's working these days. The A2CDL, K2RIW.
Yes, I am. How you doing?
I just turned it on here.
Boy, this heat has been really something. It seems that we jumped from spring to full-fledged summer overnight, and it's really been brutal. Today, just to mention, was the Limark picnic at Bethpage State Park. Good thing I know it was Bethpage because I went to Belmont Park by mistake, and then I realized which park I was in. And before that, I was at the Hall of Science AM Fair today, which was, considering the temperatures, the showing was so-so. And we did our little tune-up thing, helping out. Maybe had one or two, or maybe three customers. That's about it. At least we showed up. Dick, I just want to mention something, but I got to run downstairs, and I'll call you right back. Something that I want to get. So just want to ask you a question, or actually mention something. And as far as the audio and repeaters, I'll just mention the UHF repeater now has IOLP as well. So we completed that this past week. We put a new controller in, and Eric did a fine job in setting up the IOLP. So that's ready to go. And we've been testing it. So slowly but surely we're getting there. Amongst everything else. Yeah, I got a million and one questions, and I could take up a lot of time with a lot of things that do questions that I've been asking myself, and really I could look up on the internet a lot of the answers. But it would make for good discussions in the future. However, I do want to get just one thing, so let me just give it back to you, and I'll be right back, because I want to mention something to you. And I got to get this information. So back to you, Dick, WHCDL.
Hey, you and I have been threatening, Andy, that one of these days we're going to discuss the so-called Bessel functions and how to calculate what happens with side lobe levels on FM modulation. Okay, while we're waiting for you to go get your information downstairs, and you're carrying your handy talkie as you walk up and down the stairs so you can hear what we're saying about you, Mel, let's see if that tone is still there in your background, that 800 hertz tone, which at times as you move the mic around gets as loud as your voice. But I guess as you've got your internet emails in your hand, that they're half an inch high, and you're going to choose the one off the top. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, I'll tell you something funny about it. Do you hear the tone now? Over.
I sure do. The tone is there. Go ahead.
Okay, it has something to do with the AC lines. I don't know how high or how it's getting in there, because when the air conditioning systems are on here, both mine and my neighbor, there's a glitch on the line. I quickly plugged in a scope here. First of all, my line voltage is down considerably here. And I quickly plugged in just the scope here, my small Pectronics, and looked at you sideways. And you can see there's a little glitch that's on, moving back and forth on the sine wave when the compressors are running. And we got multiple compressors, each one for different parts of the house. So, and the lights are blinking constantly as one kicks on the other one, or the other one goes off or whatever, but I'm constantly getting blinking here. So it's a bad night here, Dick. Over.
And I'm back.
Okay. That tone is still there. I don't think you would see it as a glitch on the oscilloscope. I think you would see it as the 800 hertz tone riding on top of the 60 cycle tone, which means that there would be about 10 or 12 cycles of a very small amplitude tone riding on top of the 60 cycles. Love to know how it's getting into your mic circuit. Okay, Andy, what information did you go get? W2CDL, K2RIW.
Okay. Did you see the article from Joe Taylor, K1JT, in May issues of CQ magazine? And he wrote an article in response to your article in the March issue when you showed your antenna array and were talking about the magical wireless. You probably did see it. And you responded to Joe, if you didn't see it, you responded to Joe regarding the Doppler shift coming from aircraft that are taking off and landing, and the spectrogram that he showed. I don't know if you made a comment on that, so I just thought I'd bring it up.
Hey, you called it an article, Andy. It is a letter to the editor in the May issue. The actual article about the magic of wireless, an article about K2RIW, was in the March issue of CQ Amateur Radio. And then Joe Taylor wrote a letter to the editor, and I responded with another letter to the editor within a day or two, and both of those letters to the editor got published in the May issue. And he showed a spectrogram of the Doppler-shifted signals he gets from a 2-meter beacon that's down in the Maryland area, I think it is. And when the beacon signal reflects off of an airplane taking off from a Maryland airport, which is southwest of him, and the airplane proceeds to the southwest, he is, in my opinion, getting double-sided Doppler. In other words, the aircraft is moving away from Joe Taylor, and it's simultaneously moving away from the beacon station. So if you make believe there is a bowstring, a long string, going from the beacon station to the airplane, and the airplane is flying to the southwest, and then that string, after the signal reflects off of the airplane, goes back to Joe Taylor's house up to the northeast. So the string is getting longer between beacon and aircraft, and the string is getting longer from aircraft and Joe. Therefore, he's seeing two strings stretching at the same time, at roughly the same rate. He's getting double-sided Doppler, as I call it. That's how the very large number of feet per second of Doppler. Whenever you know the frequency of operation and you know the cycles per second of shifted frequency, you can easily, knowing the wavelength, calculate it back to feet per second of movement of something. And if you thought it was one-sided Doppler, like the airplane doing the emitting while it's moving, you would have gotten something beyond 1,000 feet per second. But it's really a much smaller number. So I think that's what you're referring to. Back to you, Andy.
There might be some geometry involved here, too, because the angle between the trajectory of the plane and the two points of observation, that might be a complex algebraic and triangulation mathematics there, because the angle changes too.
Well, you're absolutely right, Eric. But in this particular case, he told us where he's located, he told us where the beacon is located, he told us where the airport is located, and we know approximately what direction the aircraft are flying. So it is almost all parallel paths in this particular case. But yes, if the airplane was moving at right angles, what I call cross-track instead of long-track, then the Doppler shift essentially can almost go to zero. So yes, there's some complicated geometry, and it's really three-dimensional geometry because the aircraft is up at a certain altitude. But because the total number of miles to the aircraft is large compared to its altitude, you could make it into a quasi-two-dimensional problem. But Andy had some questions about this. The B2CDL, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay. No, I just wanted to mention it. If you didn't see it, and yeah, it was a letter to the editor rather than the actual article. And your response. Yeah, I read it. It's very interesting. The waterfall display that he shows, and on the spectrogram that he showed on this page, and the actual Doppler shifts and where they're located. So I just thought I just wanted to bring it up, if you didn't see it, because it was a very interesting discussion. Back to you.